This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
For the first time on my UK column show, Zachary Foster, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks so much for having me.
The last time we spoke, maybe it was about 2 years ago. Can you believe it? I mean, time has flown. But not much has changed. The world still hates Israel.
We are speaking on January 8th, 2026, more than 2 years since Israel launched its genocidal war against all 2.2 million people in the Gaza Strip, killing well over 70,000. We don't know the true number. It could be 100,000, could be 200,000, injuring more than 105,000, destroying 80, 90% of the housing stock, leaving hundreds of thousands of people, really millions of people, homeless, to fend for themselves, sleeping in the open air, in tents that get swept away every time there's a heavy rainstorm, of which there have been multiple in the past few weeks alone in the Gaza Strip. We're talking about the complete eradication of the healthcare system in Gaza. Every single day, people are dying from their untreated wounds. They're dying from communicable diseases. Children are dying because they haven't been vaccinated, because it's been 2 years since you've had regular proper vaccinations issued to Gaza's children. They're dying from malnutrition. We had over 400 Palestinians die from starvation in the past 2 years in the Gaza Strip. We haven't even mentioned the West Bank, where you have more than 40,000 Palestinians who have been uprooted and ethnically cleansed from their refugee camps in Jenin, Tul Karam, and the Nur al-Shams refugee camp. That was in December 2024 and January 2025. You've had more than 60 communities in the West Bank uprooted, ethnically cleansed, mostly from Area C. These are the shepherding communities in the north of the West Bank, in Humsa, around the E1 zone, in Khan al-Ahmar, in the central West Bank, of course, as well in the southern West Bank, in the southern Hebron Hills, in Masafar Yatta, in Susia. You've had more than 1,000 Palestinians in the West Bank murdered since October 7th, 2023. Many, many thousands more wounded. About 10,000 Palestinians remain in Israeli detention facilities. These are torture dungeons in which more than 100 Palestinians have been killed since October 7th alone, from torture, from rape, from murder, from starvation, inside Israel's torture dungeon. So here we are, 2+ years later since October 7th, and we're witnessing the most dramatic deterioration in the situation in Gaza and the West Bank since 1948.
Okay, so for my UK column audience that might not know who you are, just give me your background.
I'm a historian of Palestine. I did my PhD in Palestinian history from Princeton. I have a newsletter where I write about the history and the politics of Palestine, trying to provide historical context for the present moment. I also teach courses on the history of Zionism, the history of Jewish anti-Zionism, the history of the Palestinian people, and the history of the Palestine question. And all of that you can find at palestinenexus.com.
Okay, but now, Zachary, you are Jewish. Why then would you be so critical of Israel?
I think it's my Jewishness that has led me to become critical of Israel. I was raised on Jewish values like tzedek, tzedek tirdof. That's a biblical commandment that says justice, justice, pursue. You should pursue justice. That's a biblical commandment. There's another biblical concept, commandment, that was summarized by Rabbi Akiva when he was asked in the sayings. There's a famous book in Jewish history, Psalms, in which he's asked to summarize the entire Torah standing on one foot. And he says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's the whole Torah standing on one foot. Now, do you want to have one of the most powerful countries in the world impose a 70, dispossess you of your land, and then occupy you for 58 years, and then besiege you for 18 years, and then genocide you for 2 years? Well, if you don't want to have some other country do that to you, then why would you be doing it to someone else? I mean, that's the whole Torah standing on one foot. I don't just identify culturally as Jewish. For me, Judaism is a belief system. It's a set of values. that teaches us that we need to treat all people as equal. All people are created in the image of God. I mean, that's the basis of the Torah. That's the basis of how we should lead our lives, is that every single person, including our enemies, are created in the image of God. And so we need to pursue justice. And we need to treat others the way we want to be treated. These are the principles and these are the foundations of Judaism.
I come from South Africa. I think we're the only country in the world that is trying to hold Israel accountable. Of course, that doesn't mean good things for us. It's interesting that the U.S. is so tightly integrated into Israel. Why is that?
The United States alliance with Israel predates 1948. Every single American president, beginning with Woodrow Wilson in 1917, has supported the establishment of a Jewish state, a Jewish commonwealth, a Jewish homeland in Palestine. No exceptions, zero exceptions. Right, and that's because for many, many decades prior to the establishment of the State of Israel, you had a very important, a powerful, influential Christian Zionist movement. These are Protestant Christians who believe that at the end of days, all Jews will gather in the Holy Land, and if the Jews don't convert to Christianity, they're going to burn in hell for all eternity. That's part of their eschatological fantasy about the end of the world and the second coming of Jesus Christ. And that was, let's say, the main reason why Christians supported Israel for, let's say, the first century of the existence of the Zionist movement, which what I would say began in the 1840s with Lord Shaftesbury and the Christian Protestants in England that first called for a Jewish state in Palestine in the 1840s. You could say the second major reason that the United States supported Israel beyond the Christian theology was because you had a very powerful Zionist lobby in the United States. Again, this goes back way before 1948. You had Louis Brandeis, a very prominent Jewish American, lobbying American presidents in the 1920s and 30s to support Zionism. You had close associates of Harry S. Truman, the U.S. president in 1948, who recognized Israel's establishment when it was declared in May 1948. He also had close Zionist associates who lobbied him to recognize the State of Israel. And then after 1967, you could say the American Jewish establishment, this is the AJC, this is the ADL, the Conference of the American Presidents, that's the most important Jewish organization, which sort of subsumes all the other American Jewish organizations. They lobbied heavily to encourage the United States and the United States President, as well as the U.S. Congress, to provide Israel financial support, financial assistance, military assistance. And that lobby has only gained strength in the last few decades. And you could say, really, I think today, you can't find a single congressperson, the entire Democratic and the entire Republican Senate and congressional leadership. They're all in the pockets of AIPAC, the pro-Israel lobby, the pro-genocide lobby on Capitol Hill. The United States president himself, who are his biggest donors? Miriam Adelson has donated about $100 million every campaign cycle since 2012. She's donated billions of dollars to the Republican Party and hundreds of millions to Donald Trump himself, who announced Israel's capital was Jerusalem in 2018, or was it 2019? And that was a quid pro quo that Miriam Adelson had insisted on. So the United States government is in the back pocket of the Israel lobby. And then you do have this sort of legacy of the Cold War in which the United States saw Israel as an ally in the struggle against the Soviet Union, in which Israel would act as an American bulwark in the Middle East, fending off the Soviet allies, including Egypt and Syria. But that legacy is, I don't think, really relevant anymore. I think now you have this new rhetoric around how the United States, and you'll hear this from European leaders as well as American leaders, and how this is the greatest investment we make as an empire, right? This belief that Israel is an extension of American empire, right? So if America wants to carry out aggression against Hezbollah in Lebanon, if it thinks Hezbollah is its adversary, or Iran, or the Houthis in Yemen, or whatever it is, it sees Israel as an extension of American power and influence in the region. You could say those are some of the main reasons why the United States has become so pro-genocide and pro-Israel over the past few decades.
Okay, so your strength is in Palestinian history. Take me, if you don't mind, through the history of Palestine.
You could say the Palestine question, the Israel-Palestine conflict, as it's often described, although that's a misnomer because it's not a conflict. It's an occupation, it's a genocide, it's an apartheid. It's a struggle for justice and freedom. But a conflict is a bit of a misnomer. This struggle for this Palestinian struggle, the Palestine question, dates to the late 19th century when Jews in Europe, primarily in the Russian Empire and Eastern Europe, and to some extent Central Europe as well, began to move to Palestine with a goal of transforming this country that was 97% Palestinian Arab into a Jewish state. Now, let me just ask you this. If you try to transform a country from 97% Palestinian Arab, that is 97% Muslim and Christian, to Jewish, with the ultimate goal of subjecting that 97% of the population to the laws and the ordinances and the justice system and the legal system and the immigration policies of that minority, well, guess what? You're gonna have a conflict, and so you could say the Palestine question was a result of Jews in Europe who set out to colonize, settle, buy up as much land in Palestine, and ultimately transform the demography of Palestine from Arab to Jewish. And by 1948, the Zionists had bought up about 5.5% of the land of Palestine. They were about 1/3 of the population, so they had gone from 3% of the population in 1880 to about 33% of the population in 1947, but they were still a minority. And then when the British decided to leave Palestine and the UN called for the partition of Palestine, that led to a civil war between the Jewish population of Palestine, that foreign settler population that was hell-bent on controlling Palestine, that created Jewish cooperatives in which they hired only Jewish laborers because they were all about building a Jewish state that would guarantee Jewish prosperity, that would support Jewish labor, that would create a Jewish commonwealth for Jews and nobody else. It was an unfortunate coincidence that there were all of these Muslims and Christians, all these Palestinian Arabs living in Palestine. That was a tremendous and an unfortunate coincidence that was resolved in 1948 when the British left and the Zionists realized that in order to establish that Jewish state with a Jewish majority to guarantee Jewish prosperity in a land of 2/3 Palestinian Arabs, they would need to, wait for it, expel the Palestinian Arabs, which is exactly what they did. And so in the years, and so they expelled about 750,000 Palestinians in 1948. And that's the beginning of the crisis, right? Because, you know, in 1949, you have 200,000 homeless, propertyless, unemployed, stateless refugees living in the open air, living in tent encampments in the Gaza Strip. And it's a direct line, it's a straight line from that dispossession in 48 to where we are today.
Okay, but I was asking now, how far back does Palestine go? Because I keep hearing on social media, Palestine didn't exist. There was no such thing.
Gotcha. The word Palestine has been the subject of a great deal of controversy because, and there's a simple reason for that, right? There's no controversy over the word Syria. There's no controversy over the word Egypt or Sudan or Libya. But if you do a Google search for a timeline of the history of the name Palestine, you'll find a Wikipedia page with 500 plus footnotes. There's no equivalent Wikipedia page with 500 plus footnotes on the history of the timeline of the name Syria or Lebanon or Jordan or Iraq. None of those timelines exist. And that's because there isn't a group of people hell-bent on eradicating and erasing the very idea of Palestine in the first place. I mean, the Zionists are obsessed with eradicating even the word Palestine. They banned the word Palestine in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. If you were a Palestinian, you wanted to open up a shop in Ramallah, in Khan Yunis, anywhere in the Gaza Strip or the West Bank, you would be banned from using the word Palestine in the name of your organization, business, or association. Ask yourself, why? Well, why is it? Because the word Palestine to Israel is dangerous. Because it represents another people. It represents another identity, a people and identity that pre-existed, that predated Zionism. That's why they're so obsessed with eradicating it and telling you it never existed. And that's, in fact, the subject of my dissertation research, which is a 250-page study of the history of the usage of that word Palestine. And, of course, it predates to the ancient world, was used by Herodotus, in the ancient Greek world, and then the Romans pick it up from the Greek from the Greeks, and the Arab conquerors pick it up the Byzantines pick it up from the Romans, the Arab conquerors pick it up from the Byzantines, and you can find that word Philistine, the Arabic translation of the English word Palestine, you could probably find that word in almost every single decade, published in a text or written in a text in every single decade consistently in the Arabic language over the past 1400 years. Arabs are using that word to describe the place that today we call Palestine more or less continuously without any interruptions over the past 1400 years. And in particular, in the city of Ramleh, what is today in central Israel, it is my argument based on multiple sources from the 11th and 12th century, from the 14th and 15th centuries, from the 16th, 17th and 18th centuries and 19th centuries, that people in that city were calling the place Palestine continuously for the past 1400 years. And that you can find all of the evidence for that argument in chapter 2 of my PhD dissertation titled The Invention of Palestine.
What is a Palestinian?
A Palestinian is a subjective term, right? They're just, you can't look into someone's DNA and determine whether they're Jewish, Christian, Muslim, German, French, Israeli, or Palestinian. DNA doesn't tell you those things because those are invented categories. We just made them up, right? You can't look inside someone's DNA and tell you whether they're Palestinian or not because it's an invented identity, just like all human identities. A Palestinian today, socially, culturally, refers to a person who traces their lineage, their roots to Palestine, right? That could be a person of Bedouin background, of Druze heritage, of Jewish extraction, of Arab origin, right? So it doesn't really even say anything about your ethnic identity. It says something about where you trace your lineage to. The Palestine, right? So, I mean, and the borders, we could say, we could debate, you know, what we mean when we say Palestine, but effectively the mandatory borders, the borders that were established by the British government in 1920 when it established a mandate over Palestine, what is effectively today the state of Israel plus the occupied Palestinian territories of Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank.
And then when you talk about Zionism, what are you talking about?
Zionism, in my opinion, was a political ideology that has its historical... Zionism is a political ideology that dates to the 1640s in England, when you had a group of people, of Protestants, calling themselves Restorationists. So Zionism is initially a theological idea, not a political one. And then over the course of the 17th and 18th centuries, that idea is somewhat forgotten and is revived by Napoleon in 1798 when he invades Palestine and calls on Jews around the world to return to Palestine because he's facing heavy resistance from local forces. And he believes that if he calls on Jews around the world to support his invasion and occupation of Palestine, that he has a chance of military victory. But that ends up failing. And you don't really see a resurgence of Zionism, let's say, of political Zionism. Really, I would say I would trace that movement to the 1840s, when in England you have people like Lord Shaftesbury and many others. I'm not talking about one or two people. I'm talking about literally hundreds, thousands of people writing about Zionism in the 1840s. Okay, priests, pastors, colonial administrators. What's happening in the 1840s, and why does Zionism become a thing in the 1840s? Recall that. In 1831, the ruler of Egypt, Muhammad Ali Pasha, he invades and conquers Palestine. And he occupies Palestine for about 9 years. And the Ottomans are desperate to get Palestine back, wrest Palestine away from that Egyptian ruler, that local upstart ruler who was occupying a large swath of the Ottoman Empire. And so the Ottomans enlist British and French support to retake the Ottoman, that part of the Ottoman Empire, what is today Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, and Jordan, on condition that the British then get granted all these capitulations in the aftermath of the conquest. One of those capitulations. So now the British are confident and their imperialism is shining bright. Because they've realized that they've now helped the Ottoman Empire take back this part of the empire, only owing to their military and diplomatic efforts and their support. And this gives all these British colonial administrators and all of these British officials and the British imperial administration this idea that they should call for the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine, which would thus serve as an extension of British Empire for the same reason that the Balfour Declaration is an extension of British imperial influence in the Levant. That was the same idea in the 1840s, very similar. And so you get all these British officials. You even have the British consul in Damascus in 1840 publishes it's like an official letter. It's a statement that gets widely circulated, and he's calling for a Jewish state in Palestine in 1840. This is, by the way, long before there are any Jewish Zionists. The first Jewish Zionists, you could say, come around in the 1860s and 70s. People like Rabbi Judah Alkali and others who are strongly influenced by the European nationalisms of the era. Serbian nationalism, German nationalism, German unification, Italian nationalism and Italian unification, Russian nationalism. So all these Jews in Europe are seeing all of these national movements and wondering what role they play, right? And then they're told by the Europeans, but you're not Russian, you're Jewish, right? You're not German, you're Jewish. So the European anti-Semites deny Jews the ability to kind of play important roles in those national struggles in Europe. And so the Jews say, okay, well, if we can't be part of the German nation or the Russian nation or the French nation, well, I guess we're a separate nation. And where's our national homeland? Well, it's Palestine. And you get this movement they're initially called the Chovevei Tzion and Belu, these Zionist clubs in Eastern Europe. This is still a decade and a half before Theodor Herzl. And they form these clubs around Eastern Europe and start sending settlers to Palestine to colonize Palestine. And they establish a colonization association. They use the word colonization association. It's called the Jewish Colonization Association. That's the name they use. Because for them, colonialism is a good thing, right? Yeah, they're bringing civilization to the Orient. They're bringing progress and modernity, right? This is the rhetoric. And so they embrace the word colonialism and colonization. And they do that for about two decades. And then you get Theodor Herzl, who then, you could say, spearheads the diplomatic efforts of trying to establish diplomatic recognition for this incipient Jewish commonwealth in Palestine. And he does not achieve that. But during World War I, Chaim Weizmann does achieve that by lobbying the British to adopt the Balfour Declaration, thus supporting the establishment of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. And that sort of paves the way for the Zionist movement's successes in the 1920s and 30s, and ultimately why they established a state in 48.
But then paradoxically, do you think Israel has a right to exist?
Well, international law doesn't have opinion about whether or not any state in the international Westphalian system has a right to exist. If tomorrow Canada said, we want to create a political union with the United States and dissolve the state of Canada, international legal experts wouldn't say, well, no, that's illegal because Canada should be an independent state. No, that's not how it works. International law doesn't say any state has a right to exist. Peoples in international law have rights to exist. The Palestinian people has a right to exist. And if you try to eradicate either the Palestinian people, the German people, the Israeli people, if you try to eradicate a group of people, you would be in violation of the 1948 Convention on Prevention of Genocide. But states, no state has a right to exist. That's just even that framing, that even that language, Israel has a right to exist, doesn't stem from international legal experts. It stems from Zionist propagandists who are obsessed with demonizing anyone who is opposed to forcible displacement, ethnic cleansing, occupation, apartheid, genocide. That's the origins of that phrase.
Yes. And then by extension, Zachary, Israel is just defending itself.
Well, actually, it's false to say that Israel has a right to defend itself on occupied territory. Right. So, for example, if the United States tomorrow goes and invades a foreign country, it doesn't have a right to defend itself on that foreign country. Right. When U.S. troops get shot at in Venezuela as they're abducting a head of state, they have no right to self-defense. Zero. Any shot they fire on that foreign territory is illegal under international law because they just invaded a foreign country. They have no right to self-defense in Venezuela. Zero. And the same is, of course, true with Israel in Gaza and the West Bank, which are occupied territories. Every single shot fired inside the Gaza Strip by an Israeli soldier is illegal. They have no right to self-defense. Zero. Every single shot fired in the West Bank is illegal because every Israeli soldier stationed in the West Bank is stationed there illegally against international law. And that's because Gaza and the West Bank were territories conquered in war. And according to the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1948, which really forms the basis of the international order that we live in today, it is illegal to conquer land in war. Otherwise, we should all be praising Hitler, right? If the basic principle of international law is like founded on this idea that states are sovereign. That's the Westphalian political system. You can't, as a state, it's against the rules of international law to interfere in the internal affairs of another state, as it is against international law to invade, occupy, conquer, and annex any part of another state. And that's why all international legal experts, there's basically no exceptions, except, of course, for those Zionist legal experts who obviously are loyal to Zionism, not international law. But there's zero international legal experts that dispute this. Gaza and the West Bank are occupied territory. The ICJ just confirmed that in a July 2024 opinion, where they definitively said every single square inch of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem is occupied territory.
But Zachary, it doesn't matter because nothing happens.
Well, you're right that international law is not being abided by. Not by the United States, certainly not by Israel, certainly not by Russia and most other countries in the international system. But without international law, we're back to the law of the jungle. And if we want to return to the law of the jungle, well, then we're talking about Holocausts and genocides being the norm, not the exception. I mean, do you want to return to a world in which according to the system, the rules and engagements of the system that we live in, it's totally okay to put 6 million people in gas chambers? Like, is that a world you want to live in, where any government can just gas chamber millions and millions of people?
No, but what my question is. What you're saying is true, but Israel is just doing what it's doing.
That's correct. It is, and that's because it has the support of the United States. But you have to realize, like, that's not going to last forever. I mean, the United States isn't going to last forever, and United States support for Israel, certainly among the population, certainly among young people, certainly among Democrats, increasingly among Republicans as well, is hostile to Israel. We saw the Pew poll, was it a few months back, for the first time, a majority of Americans, when asked that simple question, do you stand more with Israel, more with the Palestinians? They now say the Palestinians. That's a complete sea change in public opinion just in the past 2+ years. You're talking about candidates like Zohran Mamdani explicitly stating their opposition to Israel as a Jewish state, preferring a state for equal rights rather than Jewish privilege and Jewish supremacy. He just won an election in New York City, and he's going to provide a blueprint for a whole new generation of politicians. He's inspired a whole generation. And in the next years, in the coming years and decades, the way to win an American political race for the U.S. Congress or for president is going to be to reject AIPAC money. That's a winning political program now. You're going to win if you say, I refuse to accept the blood money of the most genocidal organization in the United States, and that would probably be AIPAC. So that will be a winning strategy moving forward. Zohran just showed us the playbook.
Why is Israel doing this, though?
Well, the basic problem with the state of Israel is that it's trying to enforce Jewish supremacy in a land that is overwhelmingly, or let's say about half non-Jewish. I mean, the whole concept of a Jewish state is that Jews have more rights than non-Jews. If they didn't have more rights than non-Jews, it wouldn't be a Jewish state. It would just be a state. It's part of the definition of the state that Jews have to have more rights. Because if I'm a Jew outside of Israel, and I'm not allowed to move to Israel, well, what makes it a Jewish state? It's the fact that Jews outside of Israel have more rights and privileges than non-Jews inside of Israel that makes it a Jewish state, right? So the essence of the state is Jewish supremacy. The essence of the state is Jews should have more rights and more privileges than non-Jews. So, of course, any state that whose founding principle is racial ethnic privilege and racial ethnic supremacy of one group over others. That is the essential nature of the state, and that's what Israel has been trying to uphold and maintain for the past 78 years. And that's why it is such a bloody place. And that's why there's so much death and destruction. Because whenever you impose a regime of domination, you will face blowback. That is the nature of violence. If you carry out violence against someone else, which is embedded in the project of a racial state, of an ethno-supremacist state, then it's going to blow back in your face, and that's why that's why it's such a bloody violent place.
What is the sentiment, though, of Israelis themselves?
A January 2024 poll showed that 95% of Jewish Israelis believed at the time, and this is, you know, 2 years ago, when Israel had already killed about 25,000-30,000 Palestinians. So at a time when Israel had already killed 30,000 Palestinians, 95% of Jewish Israelis has said that Israel was either carrying out the right amount of force in Gaza or not enough force. We've had many polls that have come out since then that confirm those polling numbers. We had polling data just was it March 2025? So no, that polling data is already almost a year old. But in March 2025, you had Shai Chazkani publish a piece in Haaretz in which he describes the polling data, and it's just horrifying. So 82% of Israeli Jews believed in March 2025 that the Israeli government needed to empty the Gaza Strip of all its Palestinians, that every Palestinian in the Gaza Strip needed to be ethnically cleansed. About half, I bet 47 or 48% or so, agreed with the following statement. The Jewish Israelis agreed with the following statement. When the Israeli army conquers a city, it should wipe out all of the people in the city that it conquers. That's almost a direct quote of the question that was asked. So very unambiguously, do you support genocide, yes or no? About half of Israeli Jews said yes. Okay, 62% of Israeli Jews said we should ethnically cleanse, expel Palestinian Israelis who carry Israeli passports. I mean, can you imagine 62% of white Americans saying we need to strip 100% of black American citizens of their American citizenship and send them off to El Salvador? That's literally the state of affairs in Israel. You're talking about the most genocidal society on planet Earth by an order of magnitude.
Zachary, this obviously means that there's an elephant in the room, the growth of Hamas.
Well, I mean, Hamas has since, let's say, October 6th, 2023, so on the eve of the Hamas attack on southern Israel, you could say that Hamas was honestly, in my anecdotal assessment, not that popular in Gaza. I had visited the Gaza Strip twice in 2023 before October 7th, and you heard a lot of criticisms, just like you would hear criticisms of any other government, right? They were bullying street vendors, trying to impose taxes on them. They were bullying taxi drivers, trying to impose taxes on them. They were establishing state-run businesses, which would compete and push out non-state-run businesses. People were upset about that. There wasn't, as far as I could tell, a whole lot of love for Hamas and Gaza in October 2023. Excuse me. Now, what has happened over the past 2 years, I think, is as follows. Hamas has become incredibly popular in the West Bank, certainly much, much more so than they were before October 7th, 2023, because they're the only people seen as resisting. Excuse me. They're the only people seen as resisting the Israeli occupation forces. It's certainly, there's no resistance coming from Fatah. If anything, Fatah condemned all of Hamas's resistance operations. Fatah has supported Israel as it goes around the West Bank, murdering Palestinians, arresting them, detaining them, torturing them, killing them. Fatah, led by Mahmoud Abbas, is part of the Israeli occupation apparatus. It doesn't represent resistance to it. It's part of it. So Fatah has no popularity. Certainly Mahmoud Abbas, his approval ratings, if you look at his approval ratings, really they've just been in a almost down and to the right every year since, I would say, about 15, 20 years now. I mean, he's in year 17 of a four-year election. He won the race for presidency was in 2006. And what is it, 20 years later. So I believe he has less than 10% approval rating, which is shocking when you consider that about a third of Palestinians employed in the West Bank are employed by the Palestinian Authority. The people deriving salaries from this regime themselves despise it. So it's they have no legitimacy. Now, Hamas, I think, where are Palestinians on Hamas these days? Obviously, there's incredible amount of outrage at Hamas within the Gaza Strip for a feeling that they brought on this, or at least it triggered this genocidal onslaught. So I don't think Gazans are particularly happy with Hamas, certainly 2 years later when they're still living in tents, when they're still being starved, that there's no medical equipment coming in. Their lives have been completely destroyed. So I, for that reason, I don't think there's a whole lot of love for Hamas in the Gaza Strip. However, they're still the ruling party. And they still are providing the basic governmental services to the extent that any exist in the 50% of Gaza that is nominally controlled by Hamas. So in that sense, I mean, it's not like you're going to see protests against Hamas. I mean, we saw it when Hamas took over power when that ceasefire was signed, was it October 10th, 2025? We saw Hamas carry out retribution attacks against those militia members who had collaborate with the Israeli military. The Dag Mushkein, I think 20 or 30 members of that clan of effectively collaborators were executed by Hamas. Hamas reasserted its authority and is the governing authority in the 50% of the Gaza Strip along the coastal plain. We're talking about Deir al-Balah, Nusayrat, the southern parts of Gaza City. That is still controlled by Hamas. So they're still, you know, to the extent that they can, cleaning the streets, trying to clear up debris from the streets. They're still operating the hospitals to the extent that there's any medical, to the extent that the hospitals are able to operate. They're still policing the streets, right? Hamas is still in charge. They're still operating the population registry to the extent that they can. They're, you know, recording births and recording deaths, and right. So they're doing the best that they can to maintain law and order, which has obviously become incredibly difficult. So, like, I think at this point, Hamas has already said, really, since it's been 2 years in December 2023, they said, "We are very happy to step down for power. We do not want to rule the Gaza Strip anymore." They said that more than 2 years ago. And they're not willing to give up their weapons. We know that. They're willing to give up their weapons to a Palestinian army as part of a process of the establishment of a Palestinian state. And they said that many, many times. They've even gone as far as to say, look, our offensive weaponry, to the extent that we have any of it, these homemade rockets we fired at Sderot and Ashkelon, those rockets we're actually willing to put under some a kind of a keepership or in which an international force could would secure those weapons and ensure they wouldn't be used. But in terms of light arms, defensive weapons, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, there's a 0% probability that Hamas is giving that up before the establishment of a Palestinian state. So for all intents and purposes, they are and will be the governing authority in the Gaza Strip for the foreseeable future.
You're going to get criticized for sugarcoating Hamas, though, because the common trope is that they are dictatorship-type militant organization.
Yeah, I'm obviously I identify as progressive. I support free and fair elections. I believe in the rule of law. I like secular politics. I lean socialist, right? Obviously, these are things that put all of these things put me at great odds with Hamas as a political organization. Hamas carried out atrocities on October 7th. They slaughtered hundreds of Israeli civilians. Those are war crimes, and the people who carried them out should be prosecuted in international courts. I'm the first to criticize Hamas. I attack Hamas all the time. I have no love for Hamas at all. However, Hamas is every time they kill an Israeli soldier in the Gaza Strip, every time they kill an Israeli soldier stationed in Israel, stationed in the West Bank, that's legal under international law. They're not violating international law when they kill Israeli soldiers. I mean, they have a legitimate right to use force, according to international law, to resist a belligerent 58-year military occupation, hell-bent on their destruction. So, no, I mean, I have no, I'm a believer of international law, of international humanitarian law, and for those reasons, they have a legitimate right to resist. Again, assuming they follow the laws of war, which on October 7th they didn't, but they certainly have the right to resist. There's no question about that.
Am I right in saying that Hamas started out as a charity?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They in 1973, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, who was ethnically cleansed violently from his home when he was 13 from the town in what is today Israel called Juba, and wound up as a refugee in the Gaza Strip. And when he was a young adult, he founded the was effectively an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood. He preached. He was a religious person, and he founded this charity, which from 1973 to 1987, they opened up health clinics and orphanages and after-school programming for kids. They were big into women's empowerment. They believed they were helping women get jobs. And they were, of course, also all about Islamic preaching, trying to make Palestinian society more religious. And then what happened was in the 1980s, the Israeli occupation became more violent. And over the course of the 1980s, you got more and more resistance operations, not from the Islamic Hamas, which at the time was called the Islamic Collective, Al-Mujama al-Islami. It wasn't even called Hamas until 1988. But and then what happened was, after 20 years of this belligerent military occupation, in which Israel is killing 32 Palestinians every year for 20 years, in which Israel is arresting tens of thousands of Palestinians every year for 20 years, in which Israel is banning Palestinians from waving a Palestinian flag every year for 20 years, in which Israel is suffocating economic life, de-developing Palestine, according to Sarah Roy, every year for 20 years, preventing Palestinians from opening banks, from, you know, for lending practices, establishing factories, building, planting citrus trees, right? Palestinians were banned from doing all these things. They couldn't even use the word Palestine in the name of an association, as we already said. So you have a belligerent military occupation for 20 years. What happened? It's what happens with every military occupation. It breeds resistance. And so you get this spontaneous leaderless uprising in late 1987. And when that happens, and you have this mass uprising of, and it's almost overwhelmingly overwhelmingly nonviolent and overwhelmingly unarmed. We're talking about kids throwing stones at tanks. Kids throwing stones at tanks. We're talking about leafleting. We're talking about refusal to pay taxes. We're talking about sit-ins. We're talking about tire burning and blocking roads to prevent Israeli military vehicles from entering Palestinian refugee camps. We're talking about what is overwhelmingly an unarmed resistance, which was evidenced by the fact that at the end of that first year, at the end of 1988, the Israeli military had slaughtered 142 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and faced zero casualties. There may have been one, actually. And faced one casualty. It was an Israeli military police officer that was killed. But basically, this was a nonviolent uprising. And Hamas felt like if they didn't join the fray, they would be left out. It would become irrelevant. And so, much like the other factions in Palestine, they joined that uprising and carried out their first armed attack on an Israeli military target in 1989, and carried out a few more attacks in 1990, and they're still small and not well-known at that time, and they don't really become a force in Palestine until after 1994, when Baruch Goldstein, an American from Brooklyn, enters the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron on Ramadan and slaughters 28 Palestinians in a gruesome act of violence before he's beaten to death. And when you interview and you have many terrorist attacks in which Hamas kills innocent Israeli civilians after that, but it's all after 94. Very, very few attacks on civilians before 94. Hamas basically came to the conclusion that, well, you know what? If they're going to slaughter our innocent civilians, we're going to slaughter theirs. And that was a catastrophic decision for Hamas, both strategically, but also ethically. And is the reason why they became this, you know, infamous terrorist organization, right? Blowing up Israelis in cafes. That was they never able to recover from that reputation, and that's why Israelis became so radicalized against Hamas and so radicalized against Palestinian armed resistance. And it's why they became so genocidal at the end of the day. Because in a world where you believe you're superior to the other person, and in a world where they're blowing up your innocent civilians, you just say fuck them, kill them all. And that's where Israeli Jewish society wound up already, I would say, I mean, long before the genocide started. I mean, even going back to the early 2000s, you had polling data coming out of Israel. It was just shocking. I mean, Israelis became genocidal 20 years before the genocide started.
It sounds a bit like a chicken and the egg scenario. Which came first?
Well, for about, let's say, 2,000 years, there was no such thing as an Israel-Palestine conflict. Right? It didn't exist. There were Muslims, Jews, and Christians living in Palestine consistently together. I'm not saying they were living, you know, merry lives together. That the relations were always perfect. And but no, there was no such thing as an Israel-Palestine conflict. before Zionism. It didn't exist. If you told someone, who do you support in the Israel-Palestine conflict in 1840, they would have no idea what you're talking about. The reason there's a conflict in Palestine is because the Zionist movement set out to colonize a land and transform it from a country that was 97% Palestinian Arab to a country that was dominated and controlled by Jews. That is why there is violence in Israel-Palestine. That is the underlying root cause of the violence in Palestine. No one debates that. I mean, if you go back and look at the actual history, I'm writing many pieces now on actual the process of the colonization itself. And if you go look, whenever Zionists establish a colony in Rehovot in the 1880s, in the Galilee, they established multiple colonies in the Galilee, in Metula in the 1890s, in 1896. Same thing, Afula, 1911. Wherever you have, and then the same thing happens in the 1920s, in the Marj ibn Amr, in the Jezreel Valley. Every time Zionists establish a colony, guess what happens? They buy land, usually from absentee landlords, and then uproot the people living on the land. Why did they get uprooted? Because they had the wrong religion. The goal of Zionism was to place Jews in Palestine, was to establish Jewish colonies in Palestine. And so whenever they bought land, they bought land. We said it was 97% Palestinian Arabs. They would always buy land from Palestinian Arabs. And then they uprooted them and kicked them out and displaced them because they had the wrong religion. And so that, and that's why, and so the, just to finish the point. And so every time they establish a new colony, they displace Palestinians and violence breaks out. And that's the story. That's the root cause of the violence. There's no debate about that. Historians don't even debate that point.
Zionism is not necessarily a Jewish thing.
Yeah, 98% of Zionists around the world are obviously not Jewish, right? I mean, maybe it's 99.9%. I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but there's 15 million Jews in the world.
And yeah, this is an important point because there's a lot of hatred for Jews just because.
Unfortunately, many, if not most, of the most powerful Zionists and the most outspoken Zionists, not all of them, obviously, but many of them are Jewish, right? They're obviously dramatically overrepresented in terms of the people that put their money where their mouth is, that spend big bucks to elect pro-Israel candidates to the U.S. Congress, to spend big dollars ensuring every CNN host and every Fox News correspondent and every New York Times journalist is pro-Israel. The people spending the money, the people working behind the scenes to ensure mainstream media is behind Israel and doesn't use the word genocide and doesn't use the word ethnic cleansing and doesn't even call it an occupation. Those people are overwhelmingly Jewish, unfortunately. Yeah.
What would you like to see, Zachary?
I would like to see an Israel and a Palestine where no one cares what your religion is or your ethnicity. I mean, I thought this was obvious. I mean, like, did people forget the Holocaust and the Nazi and the fascist worlds in which actually the only thing that mattered was your religion and your ethnic religious identity? I mean, how did we so quickly forget that the root cause of Nazism was this idea that the only thing that matters is your identity? I mean, we need to live in a world of where politics are based on principles and values like rule of law, where everyone is treated equally before the law, like division of powers, where no one branch of the government can have too much power. For freedom of speech and civil society, where you're not abducted in the middle of the night because you tweeted something. But in Israel, none of those things are true. You get abducted in the middle of the night for tweets in Israel, both in Israel proper and in the West Bank and Gaza. In Israel proper, the only thing that matters when it comes to the state is your identity. Everything else is secondary. There's no such thing as rule of law. I mean, the whole system is based on the absence of rule of law. I mean, that's the essence of the occupation is you have no rights if you're a Palestinian. You're just abducted off the streets of Ramallah. You're sent to a torture dungeon and you're tortured to death or raped to death or starved to death. I mean, there's no due process. The whole system is built on a foundation of denying people due process. So I have the same belief system about Israel-Palestine that I have about the United States and Mexico and Canada, which is that you need a political system that is based on a set of principles that have worked and provide justice and equality and rule of law and free speech and freedom of religion to all people under its rule. And that's the basis for every society I would certainly want to live in, and I presume you as well. And that's what we need to establish in Israel and Palestine.
What happens now?
Well, Hamas actually is desperate for a two-state solution, right? The entire Hamas platform for the past decade has been a two-state, for the past two decades, really, since the early 2000s. They're desperate for a two-state solution. I mean, if you look at the articles that were first published by people like Abdelaziz Rantisi, by people like Khaled Mash'al, they were publishing op-eds in CNN and The Guardian in 2005 and 2006 saying, plagiarizing Resolution 242, plagiarizing Resolution UN Resolution 181, plagiarizing the two-state solution framework, plagiarizing all the UN resolutions and all the statements from every U.S. president and every major world leaders calling for the establishment of a Palestinian state. I mean, look at those op-eds. The one in The Guardian op-ed in 2006, they were making the case that we want a Palestinian state whose borders would be the June 5th, 1967 borders, that is the entirety of the Gaza Strip, the entirety of the West Bank, with East Jerusalem as its capital, and a just and fair solution to the Palestinian refugee issue. I mean, that's what international law says as well, by the way. Hamas, if you want to accuse them of anything, you can accuse them of plagiarizing international law. Now, the problem is that on the Israeli side, there's no desire to give Palestinians a state at all. I mean, every single leader in the state of Israel, every single one, every single Jewish Israeli leader, zero exceptions, zero, not one exception, zero exceptions, supports Israel's apartheid rule in the West Bank, supports expanding settlement expansion, supports holding on to the Gaza Strip and the West Bank forever. Right, the only Jewish Israeli member of the Knesset who voted against, there was a resolution that came before the Israeli Knesset in this past summer, so the summer of 2025. The resolution was brought forward by, I think, one of the Arab parties. And the resolution said, you know, we support the establishment of a Palestinian state. There was a single Jewish Israeli Knesset member. His name is Ofer Kassif. He was the only one that supported that resolution. You're talking about 99% of Jewish Israeli parliamentarians, including those representing the far left parties. I mean, there's no such thing as a far left Jewish Israeli party in Israel. But the furthest left you can go in Israel, they reject the establishment of a Palestinian state and support permanent Israeli apartheid. They support the permanent subjugation of 5.5 million Palestinians forever. That they should be enslaved to the Israeli military forever. That's the position of 98% of Israeli Jewish political leaders.
Zachary, what would happen if the United States pulled all of its funding?
No, that's a very good question. And I think, I would say most analysts, I think, get this question wrong. I think there's this belief that if the United States cut off funding, that Israel's toast. I don't think that's true. I think Israel has a lot of allies around the world. Now, I'm not saying they're going to get as good a weapons as the F-35. I'm not saying they're going to get the 2,000-pound bunker buster bombs. I'm not saying they're going to get, you know, the best air defense technology as part of its Iron Dome system. They're not going to get top-of-the-shelf, you know, cutting-edge American military tech, including AI, including these systems that make it incredibly easy for Israel to slaughter Palestinians at record paces. But you have China, you have Russia, you have Serbia, you have Germany. You have a lot of weapons. You know, there's a lot of people who are very happy to sell weapons to Israel. That's the world we live in. So I think it's overblown. I think Israel would suffer tremendously, right? Where they would especially suffer would be also be in the diplomatic realm. Right now, they don't have a veto at the UN. The UN Security Council could pass a resolution calling for a foreign military to grant authority to a foreign military force to invade and occupy Israel. Right, so that you know, losing the diplomatic support is also very important. Perhaps even more important, as we said, which you know, in comparison to the military support, which, like we said, I think there are replacements for us. Maybe not the ones Israel would like, but people will sell Israel weapons. I'm not worried about that. And in addition, Israel's claimed, at least Netanyahu has claimed, a $100 billion plan to invest in its own military manufacturing capabilities. Now, obviously, that's going to take a long time to get off the ground, and who knows if it'll succeed. But I think people overblow the United States' I think people think that if the United States cut off weapons tomorrow, that would be the end of Israel. It would certainly hamper Israel's ability to kill Palestinians. There's no question about that. Well, I mean, if you stop sending the 2,000-pound bombs, there's no 2,000-pound bombs to drop on Gaza.
Mm. But Zachary, I mean, Israel also needs to defend itself against the entire Arab world that wants to wipe it off the face of Earth.
I think the evidence suggests the opposite, that it's Israel that is occupying, invading, annexing, attacking the rest of the Middle East. Iran has never attacked Israel. It responded to Israel's acts of aggression. Iran has never attacked Israel. When has Lebanon carried out an offensive war against Israel? Never. Hezbollah has, but certainly not the state of Lebanon. What about Syria? Under Assad, under the pro-Palestinian Assad, when did Syria attack Israel? Never. When did Egypt attack Israel? Was Israel that attacked Egypt in 67, and then Egypt attacked Israel in 73, trying to get back the territories that Israel stole from it. When did Saudi Arabia, the Gulf, UAE? I mean, the United Arab Emirates is about as close an ally as Israel has in the entire world. But Qatar? When did Qatar attack Israel? In fact, the United States begged Qatar to host Hamas officials during over the course of the negotiations over the past 2 years. I mean, Israel's a menace. It's a regional menace. It has no regard for human life, certainly not Palestinian life, Lebanese life, Iranian life, Syrian life. It's slaughtered 1,000 Iranians. It's slaughtered thousands of Lebanese. It's killed hundreds and hundreds of Syrians. It's killed hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. And what have any of those countries done to Israel? I mean, you got the story wrong. Israel is an expansionist state. And the rest of the regime would love to have nothing more than a peace treaty with Israel so that it stops attacking its neighbors. I mean, that's what Saudi Arabia wants. They had the Arab Peace Initiative from 2002 already, going back 23 years. Basically saying, look, just stop attacking, stop occupying, stop invading, stop conquering, stop killing. We just want peace.
I asked you earlier what you would like to see. Now my question is, what do you actually think is going to happen in the next, I don't know, 10, 15 years? Are we going to be having the same conversation again?
I think the most likely scenario is a continuation of what is happening today. People have this, but whenever you get, especially 10, 15, I mean, who knows what will happen in 10, 15 years? We can't possibly predict that. That's way too out and further out in the future. But certainly for the coming years, certainly for the rest of the Trump presidency, no, we're just going to see more of the same. Well, a ceasefire in which 5 to 10 Palestinians are killed every day. If, by the way, 5 to 10 Israelis were killed every day during the ceasefire, they would call it a massacre. They would call it mass murder. If Hamas killed 400 Israeli civilians in the past 2.5 months, Hamas would be accused of carrying out another October 7th. But when Israel kills 400 Palestinians in 2.5 months, they call it a ceasefire. So we'll see more of the same. We'll see Israel continually encroaching and expanding their control of the Gaza Strip. We'll see Israel continuing entrenching its apartheid rule, expanding the settlement enterprise, more settler violence, more ethnic cleansing operations. Israel will probably push further into Syria. It will continue to bomb Lebanon at will. It'll probably launch another war with Iran. It will continue to attack the Houthis. It'll try and get ethnically cleanse Palestinians to Somaliland. I mean, it's a very bleak picture.
Israel is nearing 100 years. Do you think it's going to make it?
I think Israel will be a pariah state for a long time before it collapses altogether. I mean, North Korea has been completely cut off from the for literally decades and decades and decades, and it seems to have survived. So I think people underestimate the ability of a regime to survive, assuming it has some amount of international support. I mean, look at Cuba. Look at how long Cuba survived, despite having such a belligerent neighbor in the United States so close. So regimes can survive for a lot longer than I think people realize.
But one thing is for certain, the world does seem to be changing its position on Israel.
There's no question about that. I mean, Israel is becoming a pariah state, and that trend will only increase in the years to come, right? The more ICC warrants, arrest warrants for more Israeli leaders, more ICJ rulings. I'd be shocked if the ICJ doesn't rule it's a genocide. I think the the arms embargoes from countries will only continue and pick up. I think that the United States is, as we already pointed out, becoming a country that is increasingly supportive of the Palestinian people, and that will eventually trickle down into politics, as we certainly would hope so. Latin America is increasingly hostile to Israel, especially now, as Israel is seen as implicated in this illegal attack on and abduction of Nicolas Maduro. So I think Israel is becoming a pariah state everywhere. That those trends will only increase. And I think Israeli society is just becoming more genocidal. The apartheid regime is entrenching itself. So all the things that are pushing Israel, creating this environment, Israel is becoming an apartheid state and is becoming a pariah state. All those trends are only increasing and entrenching themselves. So in the future, Israel's status as a pariah state will only also entrench itself.
All right, Zachary, how can my audience follow your work?
You can find me on Twitter _ZachFoster. And if you want to follow all my writings, you can find those at PalestineNexus.com.
I must admit, I love your website. All those maps are particularly fascinating.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we have a collection of digital maps. I've collected many, many thousands of maps, mostly of Palestine and the Middle East, the Ottoman Empire, dating to, I think, we have maps going all the way back to the 17th century. So it's an antique collection, and you can find all those maps. All of them are downloadable, high-resolution maps for free at PalestineNexus.com.
Zachary Foster, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks so much for having me.